Romans 11. And we are going to be in the verses Rebecca read earlier, 13 through 24. So Meghan Markle, is that how you say her last name? Markle? Not anymore, right? I mean, it's different. She got married. But before. After she married Prince Harry, now she's Duchess of Sussex. And the hard work begins. You know, the wedding was so beautiful. We all saw, you know, pictures at least, or maybe video, or maybe we got up and watched the thing. But now the hard work begins. Evidently, for the next 6 months, she is going to be going through lessons on how to be royal. I think we can understand that any one of us, if we found ourselves in the same position, would have to get lessons on what it meant to be royalty, especially if we weren't brought up in the UK, where we could just watch and kind of get lessons that way. I don't know. But for the next 6 months, they tell me that she's going through lessons on what it means to be royalty. She will have to make many changes in her life. One thing that she will have to change is she will no longer be able to wear brightly colored nail polish, that all of her nail polish will need to be more subdued, I guess, royal colors. She will no longer be allowed to go in public with bare legs. She will always have to wear tights, not bright tights, but more subdued colors, royal color tights, but she will have to wear tights everywhere that she goes. She'll have to get lessons in diplomacy. That makes sense. Whenever she meets a dignitary from a foreign country, she will need to know how to address them, how not to address them, I guess, as the case may be. She will no longer be allowed to give autographs. Royalty, don't do that. Royalty are royalty. They are not celebrities. And so no more autographs. She will no longer be allowed to take selfies. She will no longer be allowed to take selfies with other people. In fact, I think she's already been asked to do that, and she politely declined and said, we are not allowed to do that. So, in fact, she deleted all of her social media accounts, which is probably not a bad idea for public figures, and maybe we should adopt that as in the United States of America. But she is not allowed to have a social media account. She's going to have to minimize her accent, being from America. She's going to at least try to sound less American and maybe more British, I don't know. She's going to have to get rid of the Americanisms in the things that she says. She will no longer be allowed to refer to these as pants. These are not pants. These are trousers, apparently, in the UK, and so she's got to get rid of, you know, I don't know, is she going to call it the loo or the WC? What do royalty call the bathroom? I'm sure she can't call it the bathroom anymore, but anyway. She's going to have to brush up on her table manners. Did you know that there's a difference between a fish fork and a dessert fork? Did you know that there was such a thing as a fish fork? I got to confess, I didn't. But apparently, there is a fish fork, and it's at least close enough to the dessert fork that you can get those confused. And she's got to learn the difference. I'm sure that many of you in the room have been in a situation where there's more than just knife, fork, and spoon, and you had to figure out, you know, either ahead of time or on the fly, that there were certain spoons to use and certain spoons not to use. I always just abide by the rule, work from the outside in, right? And when in doubt, I just strike up a conversation with somebody while the next course is being served and act like, oh, is it time to eat that yet? What are you using? Okay, I'll use that. That always works, but I think that the Duchess of Sussex is going to have to know these things going in. She's not going to be able to work on the fly. Many of us know about table etiquette. Many of us were schooled in table etiquette as we grew up. I can remember my second grade teacher, when we're in the cafeteria, singing a song to us, get your elbows off the table, Ryan Berryhill, get your elbows off the table. What? It's so comfortable, and it's just got a nice stand there. Why do I have to get my elbows off the table? But table etiquette can be a big deal, and it can be an extremely big deal when you're dealing with people from a different culture. just in the limited parts of the world that I have been in. I know that there are things that you do and things that you don't do. When Bob and I were in Armenia, you do not finish what's in front of you unless you want more. And so if you want them to stop bringing you stuff, leave a little bit on your plate. That's the etiquette there. In other cultures, if you don't eat everything on your plate, they go, well, what's wrong with our food? You know, so you have to know where you are. You have to know how to act. You even sometimes have to know what to eat and what not to eat. Table etiquette is huge in the New Testament. It's so much bigger, I think, than a lot of times we realize. So many things happen around the table in life, in our own lives, in the lives of the people of the ancient Near East. And table etiquette was especially a big deal for the God told them in the law of Moses that there were things that they could eat and there were things that they couldn't eat. And the things that they could eat and couldn't eat marked them out as God's people. And so when it comes time for Jesus to show up on the scene, when it comes time for Paul's day, they still had these rules, and they were huge rules for them. These are what mark us off as the people of God, and these are maybe sometimes as importantly what mark those people off as not being a part of the people of God. And so much so that whenever the gospel begins to go out to the Gentiles, and Gentiles are simply non-Jewish people, when the gospel begins to go out to the Gentiles, it's a huge roadblock, because if you haven't noticed, if you can't eat with somebody, you can't be really close to them. And so for me to say, yeah, I want you to be a part of my family, but I'm sorry we can't eat together, I'm grossed out by what you eat, it just doesn't work. Even worse, I'm sorry we can't be a part of the same family because you aren't eating the stuff that God said you should eat. And you are eating the stuff that God said you shouldn't eat. And so there's this tremendous barrier between the Jewish people and the Gentile people, and Paul is having to overcome this in this church in Rome where there's supposed to be this blend of Jew and Gentile, and there's some conflict here. In fact, last week at chapter 11, verse 9, he quotes Psalm 69, and in that psalm, David says, let their table become a snare and a trap. And a lot of people, myself included, think there's a nod to this phenomenon here, that the very table that they pride themselves on, the food that they can't eat and they can't eat, has become a trap to them. It's become a stumbling block that has blinded their eyes to the truth of the good news about Jesus. And so Paul, a Jew, is having to navigate through this. But not only this, not only is there discrimination when it comes to table manners, there's also reverse discrimination going on in the Roman church. Because at the time that Paul is writing, there's been something that's happened in the capital city that's completely changed the dynamic. As we talked about last week, the very first Christians were Jews, and then it started spreading out to the Gentile people, and it's very likely that the first Christians in Rome were Jewish. And it's very likely that the leaders in that church were Jewish. But then something happened maybe around a decade before Paul wrote this letter. There was a riot in Rome. There was a fight among the Jewish people. And the emperor Claudius, he doesn't differentiate between, okay, here are some Jews who do believe Jesus is the Messiah, and here are some Jews who don't believe. And he's not going to get into all that. He's just going to say, all Jews gone. If you're going to cause this trouble, we're just going to kick you all out. Historians tell us that they said the riot was over somebody named Crestus. And Crestus is a slave name, and it's very possible that they misunderstood. It was probably about Christos, Christ, the Messiah. That's probably what the squabble was about. The Romans, they don't know. Christus, okay, that's who it, Crestus, okay, you're all out of here. We don't like riots, we don't like troublemakers, and so he kicks all of the Jewish people out. And that lasts for several years until Claudius dies, and then it's kind of like what happens in politics. One political leader says these people are kicked out. Then when he's gone, they're allowed back in. And so this is what's happened here. The Jewish people can come back in. And by this time, they've been gone so long, it's only left Gentile people in the church. And so the leadership is Gentile. But here come these Jews, and they say, well, we were part of this church before you were. And, you know, maybe they wanted back the places of leadership. Maybe they wanted to assume, you know, I was a deacon when I left. I should be a deacon now. And maybe some of the Gentiles were saying, no, you've been gone. You've been gone for years. Why should we just allow you back into this position of leadership? It's a power struggle. It's struggle over turf. And as I said last week, I know this is very difficult for us Baptists to wrap our brains around, that there can be power struggles in the church over turf and these kinds of things. But it happens, and it was probably happening in this church in Rome. And so there's probably reverse discrimination going on here. We don't want these folks to come back and assume the power places that they had in the church, because we're quite happy with the way the church is now. And then they probably did what some people do, and used their theology to justify their hold on power and their hold on turf. And so they probably begin to say things like, well, the Jewish people are rejecting Jesus anyway. Well, God has probably turned his back on the Jewish people, because after all, it's the Jewish leaders who handed Jesus over to be crucified. You know, God's done with the Jewish people. Why should we allow them to come back in our church? And on top of that, why should we allow them to come back in and assume these positions of authority? God probably wanted them out anyway. That's probably, you can see how that would work. And so now Paul is having to walk this line where, on one hand, he starts to talk about the Jewish people, that God sent Jesus to make this one family out of all humanity, Jew and Gentile. But then on the other, he's saying to the Gentile people, don't you dare write them off, because God is not done with them yet. And so that's where we are in Romans chapter 11. In 13, he says this, "Now I am speaking to you Gentiles." So he's switching audiences here. I'm speaking to you Gentiles, or at least he's directly toward them. "Insofar as I am the apostle of the Gentiles, I celebrate my particular ministry, so that if possible, I can make my flesh jealous," my flesh being the Jewish people, that's who Paul's talking about, "and save some of them. If they're casting away, you see, means reconciliation for the world, what will their acceptance mean but life from the dead?" I want us to notice three things, at least, about these three verses. And the first one is this. It ought to go without saying, but you know I like to point these things out. May I submit to you that God cares about racism? We have read Romans so generically, so often, that we just blow right through the Jew-Gentile distinction and tension. And what Paul is trying to do here is resolve an issue that has everything to do with racism. "I am talking to you Gentiles. There is racism among Jews and there's racism among Gentiles, and Paul has to smooth things out because Jesus came to make one body composed of one humanity." The Jewish people look at it like this. There are two kinds of people. There are Jews and there's everybody else. Everybody else is the Gentiles. And so Paul has to set that right. And then there's probably racism going on here in the church, because we don't want them to come back and assume the places of leadership that they left. And so Paul has to address that. Because it means nothing, friends. It means nothing. We can say we love all kinds of people, but it means nothing unless all kinds of people are worshiping together. We can say all we want to that we love all people, but unless the church on the inside looks like the community on the outside, it means nothing. It's what Paul's trying to do here in Romans. It is the heart of the gospel. The heart of the gospel is that Jesus died for Jew and Gentile to make them not two people who exist in separate places, but in Jesus to make one humanity. Read Ephesians. And if that one humanity is not reflected in our places of worship, then shame on us. Number two, what we can see in these verses is that your actions matter. That we need intentionality and we need deliberation to make things like this happen. This cracks me up, this verse here, because it makes some people break out in hives. Did you catch what Paul said? in verse 14. He says, I'm trying to make, a big reason why he's an apostle sent to the Gentiles is so that when he takes the good news of Jesus to them and they enjoy the blessings of God through Jesus, that hopefully some Jews, some of his own flesh will see what's going on and they'll get jealous and they'll say, we want some of that. But look how Paul words this. I want to make my flesh jealous, he says, and save some of them. Who's doing the saving in this sentence? In this sentence, who is doing the saving? I want to make them jealous and save some. Paul. Paul says, I want to save some of my fellow Jews. And I can just hear some well-meaning Christians who feel it is their duty to point out how bad we all are and how it's only the work of God and we have nothing to do with it. I can hear some of my friends say, now, Paul, you don't save anybody, Paul. God saves people, Paul. You don't save anybody. And we might say, okay, well, maybe Paul just had a slip of the tongue here, which is going to really do wonders with our view of the inspiration of Scripture, or if some people use the word inerrancy. But we could say, oh, well, maybe Paul had a slip of the tongue here, except this isn't the only time he says something like this. You remember in 1 Corinthians 9, whenever Paul is saying to the Jew, I become as a Jew in order to win some. To the Gentile, I become as a Gentile in order to win some. To the slave, I become as a slave in order to win some. To the free, I become as the free in order to win some. I become all things to all people, Paul says, in order that I might save some. He says it twice. So are we to believe that Paul has a slip of the tongue twice? Come on, Paul, you know that you don't save anybody, that it's God who saves. Paul knows that. Have you read the rest of Romans? He has said that God is the one doing the saving. But I think it's a powerful point here that Paul also sees in his ministry as he goes out and takes the good news of Jesus to the nations, that he is saving them. That he, being involved in God's work, is saving them. That God is doing God's saving work through Paul. So much so that he can take so much ownership in it that he says that I might save some. We try so hard to cut things up and try to divide out what's God's doing and what's human doing. And the New Testament just doesn't do that. Paul in 2 Corinthians 5 says, he became sin, Jesus, who knew no sin, that we might become the righteousness of God. Now, what that doesn't mean is that somehow the righteousness of Jesus was downloaded in our account. It doesn't say that. It says that we might become the righteousness of God. And we've already talked about what the righteousness of God is. The righteousness of God is God's saving activity, God carrying out this plan that God hatched with Abraham, that God is carrying this out to save the world. And what Paul is saying is that he and his co-workers, as they are going around taking the gospel to people, that they embody God's righteousness, God's plan, God's activity of saving this world. That Paul going out and telling people about Jesus is God saving the world. I submit to you, number one, that there is not the difference that we try to pretend that saving is something that God does on the inside. And that it doesn't involve anything but something going on in the inside. That is just as unbiblical as it can be. May I submit to you that God does and always has uses human beings to accomplish God's will in the world. That's the way God arranged the world when God set up humanity to take care of the world. That's why God needed to become a man to die for us, to rise again, to accomplish God's plan, because God does what God does through human beings. That's the way it's set up. And I submit to you that we can take encouragement and we can take challenge and we can take authority in that whenever we go out to the world and reach them for Jesus, it is God saving the world using us. Okay. You know, it's kind of like, y'all hear the story of the school shooter in Indiana, Noblesville, Indiana, where this guy gets up in class and he has a gun and he's just going to start shooting at everybody. And the teacher, I think he was a coach, he had a ball somewhere close to him. That's why I think he's a coach. I don't know if he was or not. But he takes the ball and he throws it at the shooter. And when that doesn't stop him or distract him enough, the teacher goes straight for the kid and tackles him. And in the process, takes three shots, shot three times. He survived. I think one girl was shot, and I think she survived. But he stopped a horrible incident because he went after himself, put himself on the line, went after and tackled the shooter. He saved them. But I can just hear something. Now, you didn't save anybody. Well, why are we comfortable saying he saved when his activity goes out and, you know, but if we go out and we talk to people about Jesus, we embody the gospel in what we do. Well, no, that wasn't you. It's because of this unhealthy dichotomy we have between something that goes on the inside and stuff that, but God is always, God wants to use us full body and spirit. And God does use us. I mean, anyway, maybe I'm beating a dead horse, but maybe you can see where I'm coming from. But thirdly, I want you to notice something, and this is really where Paul is going in these verses that we are looking at. What God wants to do, friends, is about more than you or your kind. May I submit to you? You know, hear what they're hearing. Paul says to them, you know, and I'm putting words in his mouth. He really says, the reason why that I go out and win Gentiles is just to make the Jews jealous so they'll come to Jesus. Now, how does that affect their self-esteem? The reason why I'm trying to reach you is really not about you, it's about them. It's basically what Paul just says here. I mean, in a way, it kind of sounds like in middle school and high school when two people are dating and then like they break up with each other and one still has a flame for the other and they go get a boyfriend or girlfriend really quick to make the first one jealous. You know what I'm saying? Anybody been there? And then everybody says, well, they're just with him to make him jealous, or they were just with her to make her jealous. I mean, this kind of sounds like what's going on. That the Jews, by and large, have rejected the good news, and so Paul goes over here, well, maybe they'll accept it and then make you jealous because you're really who I'm after. Yeah, this probably took them down a few notches. Those who are saying, no, we don't want them back in the church, no, we don't want them back in the leadership positions, Paul says, well, let me tell you the truth. The real reason that we're trying to reach the Gentiles is just to get them back into the fold. Now, of course, with God, it works differently because God can date more than one, right? God can draw Jew and Gentile, and that's all good. But, point taken, Paul. But look what he says about the Jewish people. I'm trying to make them jealous so they'll come back in. He says, look at verse 15. If they're casting away, you see, means reconciliation for their world, for the world. They're casting away. Their rejection. Paul is framing what's going on with the Jewish people not as they've rejected, they've been cast away, God is done with them. He's using the same kind of terminology that Jesus was rejected for our sake, and so it led to our salvation. Paul is saying even that this rejection of the Jewish people has a saving purpose in God's plan. It's not just we're done with them, God's done with them. It's that even their rejection serves a purpose, serves a greater purpose to rescue all of humanity. Paul says, what will their acceptance mean but life from the dead? This is the terminology he's been using in this book to talk about Jews coming to faith in Jesus. If you remember the story in chapter 4, and I'm talking especially verse 17, when he talks about Abraham, he says that we need to believe that God is a God who can raise the dead and call things as if they weren't. And probably what that means is raise things from the dead probably has to do with the Jewish people. Goes back to that dry bones thing, that God can, even though Israel has rejected by and large, that God can speak and they can rise. And then the Gentiles, who never were going after God, it's like calling things as if they weren't. Whenever God calls the Gentiles to himself, he's saying, boom, you're my people, even though you never were. And so what Paul is saying here is there's this, what Ezekiel was talking about in 37 will happen whenever the Jewish people come to faith in God. I also want you to notice something else, friends. Whenever Paul says that God has hardened, I've said to you before, I say to you again, it does not mean that God decided before all time began that some will go to hell and some will go to heaven. And some people will tell you that's what it means, and some people will tell you if you don't believe that's what it means, you don't believe the Bible. But I suggest to you that you read the Bible and what the Bible is saying. Paul has said that God has hardened Israel, and yet Paul is also saying that there are more to come into the fold. You following? Hardening Israel does not mean, boom, they're assigned to hell. Hardening of Israel means delayed judgment to allow time for people to come. And Paul says, some will come. So don't let anybody tell you, A, that hardening applies to individuals. It applies to peoples. And in this case, it applies to Israel. And don't let anybody tell you that it means that they are doomed because God has said it. This is not what Romans 9 through 11 say. More on that next week. Let's move on. Verse 16, take another illustration, Paul says. If the first fruits are holy, so is the whole lump. This is talking about him, John, Mary Magdalene, the Jewish people who have come to faith in Jesus, the ones that Paul talked about last week when he says, is God done with Israel? No way. Some of us are coming to the fold. And what Paul is saying here is, if we have come into the fold, this first fruits idea from places like the book of Leviticus, if the first fruits are dedicated to God, the whole lump is. So Paul's saying, don't throw away, don't write off the whole lump of Israel, because some of us have come to faith. And because we have come to faith, it sort of sanctifies the whole. Doesn't mean that necessarily that they're saved, but it does mean that they are sanctified. It's like in 1 Corinthians 7 when Paul says if there's a believing spouse and an unbelieving spouse, the believing spouse sanctifies the children. He's talking about this godly influence. He's talking about don't write them off, don't kick them out, that there's still a hope, there's still something special going on for them. And then Paul makes his metaphors, or throws in another one on here. And another, if the root is holy, so are the branches. Who is the root? What is the root? Some people say it's Israel. Some people say it's the patriarch. Some people say it's God. I think it's Jesus. I think that's pretty clear. Isaiah talks about the Messiah as the root of Jesse. Paul quotes this later on in this book in 15:12, and Paul says, their kinsman, according to the flesh, is the Messiah. So don't write them off. The root is still their kinsman there. Then he takes off with this idea of branches and roots and trees, and he says in verse 17, but if some of the branches were broken off, and you, a wild olive tree, were grafted in among them, and came to share in the root of the olive with its rich sap, don't boast over the branches. If you do boast, remember this, it isn't you that supports the root, but the root that supports you. So Paul has this picture of a tree, Jesus as the root. And the tree grows out of the root, and there are branches. And what Paul says is that some of Israel, because they have not believed, that they've been broken off the tree. And the places where they've been broken off, some Gentiles, these wild olive, they're not the cultivated olive branches. They're these wild olive branches. They have been put on. It's one tree, it's Israel, and these Gentiles have been put on it. But Paul says, don't you dare boast, because you aren't supporting the tree. You've just been grafted on. It's the root that supports the tree. None of us can boast. Whole message of Romans, not Jew, not Gentile, because we all depend on the root, and that is Jesus, what he has done for us. Verse 19, I know what you'll say next. Branches were broken off so that I could be grafted in. I mean, you can see that, you know, coming a mile off. Yeah, but they were broken off. I was put on. That makes me something special. Paul says, verse 20, that's all very well. They were broken off because of unbelief, but you stand firm by faith. In other words, it's just your faith. It's not because of anything, you know, you are about. It's by faith in Jesus. It's faith in the root. That's why you stand faith. Don't get big ideas about it, he says. Instead, be afraid. After all, if God didn't spare the natural branches, there's a strong possibility he won't spare you. Don't get obnoxious. Don't get haughty. Don't get prideful. The other branches were broken off. You can be broken off too. Now, is this saying that we can lose our salvation? Is this saying that something else? Friends, I think there are enough stern warnings in Scripture that say, stay the path, stay true to the faith, that we better heed them, okay? Stay on the path, stay connected to the tree, stay connected to the root. Let's just do it, all right? And let's heed the warning. But there's also the possibility that instead of the individual that Paul's talking about here, he may be talking about the church itself. And what he may be saying is, just as the Jews who became inwardly focused, who said that you can come to be a part of the people of God if you become like us, if you eat the same things that we eat, if you observe the same days that we observe, if you circumcise your children, you can come and be a part of the people of God, but you got to come become like us for that to happen. What Paul may be saying is, whenever God's people become inward like that and forfeit their call to be the light to the world, that is the sure sign of death. And if you, Roman church, make it about yourself, if you make it about you, then your death is not far off. God will break off you as a church just as sure as God has broken off other inwardly focused groups. Keep reading. Verse 22, note carefully then that God is both kind and severe. That's kind of a strange thought, isn't it? Kind and severe. He is severe to those who have fallen, but he is kind to you, provided you continue in his kindness. Otherwise, you too will be cut off. And they too, if they do not remain in unbelief, will be grafted back in. So again, it's not a final thing. If they turn, they're grafted back in. God is able, you see, to graft them back in. For if you were cut out of what is by nature a wild olive tree and grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, how much more will they, the natural branches, be grafted back into their own olive tree? And some people have said, Paul here is just showing his ignorance. That's not even the way things work. Usually, whenever people do grafting, they take a wild tree and they graft a cultivated branch onto it. Paul's got it backwards here. He says you've taken a cultivated root and you grafted a wild branch into it. And that's what Paul, that's his point. In fact, he says contrary to nature in verse 24. Paul's saying God is doing what is backwards is all get out. That normally you take the wild root and you graft in a cultivated branch, but God has done the opposite with you. And so if you don't think that God could just regraft a cultivated branch in, you got another thing coming. God has done the weird thing by letting you Gentiles in. And if a person out of Israel comes to faith in Jesus, it is nothing for the God of the universe to cultivate them back in. Get over yourselves, Paul says. You know, I see in Romans, I see judgment potentially on the horizon. I see judgment potentially on the horizon for this church that is struggling with those three issues that churches who are unhealthy struggle with. I had a professor in my DMN work up in TEDS say there are three issues that cause fights in the church. They are power, turf, and money. And any of us who have been around long enough have seen these issues pop up over and over again. I think the power and the turf issue is an issue in the Roman church, and it's leading to racism. It's justifying racism, and Paul is saying, you have got to nip this in the bud, to borrow another agricultural analogy, I guess, or God's coming. The judgment is coming. God can cut you off just as well as God has cut other branches off. Whenever we fight over power, turf, and money, and whenever we use our theology to justify our battles over power, turf, and money, we find ourselves in the same predicament and with the same warning. And I suggest to you that the American church, as it stands now, that the judgment of God is coming to roost among us because we have had struggles over power, turf, and money, and because we have used theology to justify it. Just this week, I hear ridicule and justified over secular news stations because a pastor has asked his congregation to give so that he can have a $54 million jet. I hear this week that there is a Catholic diocese up north that has settled for $200 million with victims of sexual abuse in their diocese. And I read that a president of Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary has been fired because he mishandled rape allegations on both of the campuses he has been president of. What do all these three things have in common? Power, turf, money. Because God's people get the feeling that they are bigger than God's kingdom, and that their kingdom is bigger than God's kingdom, and protecting their kingdom is more important than God's kingdom. And shame on us. Power, turf, money, we find reasons to justify those, and we find reasons to stay apart from one another, though God calls us to be a family. The heart and soul of Romans is that Paul is calling these people, Jew and Gentile, to be a part of the same family. Not just in word, not just in idea, not just on the inside, but in actuality. And that comes when and only when we give up our insistence on power, turf, and money. We find reasons to stay apart, and we justify them theologically. And the reason why we want to stay apart is because we want to hold on to our power and our turf and our money. Someone says, God told me to start this church. Well, how can you argue with that? God told me to start this church over here. And why? Because we're going to do it right. Now, there's no arrogance in that statement. It seems every time I drive to Longview, Texas, there's a new church with some weird name. Because that's what we need, a new church with a weird name, because that's going to demonstrate the good news of Jesus. One more other church. I found out this morning we have 116 churches in Marshall, Texas. 116 churches in Marshall, Texas. And I ask you, why? It's because of arrogance. It's the arrogance of, we can do it right. It's the arrogance of those people. We read the New Testament and we say, you know, the difference between the Jew and the Gentile was that the Jews were legalistic, and the Gentiles are all about freedom, and we should all be about freedom. And so in the name of legalism, we say, they're doing it wrong, they're legalistic, we're going to be free over here. Which is baloney. It's anti-establishment nonsense. It's anti-rules, anti-structure. Well, they're too structured. It's anti-education. Well, we're not going to be chained by those things. And then you go in their services and it's the same thing every Sunday. Somebody's chained when they're doing the same thing every Sunday, even if they're doing it in a crazy way. Well, we do real worship over at our church. We aren't bound by prayers that are read. We aren't bound by liturgy. We aren't bound by order. We do things as God intended. We have real worship. We close our eyes and we sway to the music, because that's what it's really about, friends. It's about standing in the darkness and swaying in the music. That's what God really wants out of Christians. You know, you would think if that's really the essence of spirituality, that Jesus would have done it at least once. Right? At least once. Jesus' disciples didn't come up to him and say, "Lord, teach us how to sway." They said, "Lord, teach us how to pray." But we justify everything theologically to keep us apart. And God has called us, male and female, Jew and Gentile, slave and free, to be one. Not in an idealistic sort of way, but in actuality. One day I'm going to write a book. I know I've told you this before, but I'm really going to do it one day. The book is going to be entitled Getting Over Yourself. And it's going to be subtitled Confessions of a Recovering Self-Addict. The longer I live and the more I read Scripture, I've come to the determination that following Jesus is all about getting over yourself. You just spend a lifetime of getting over yourself. My kingdom, my power, my turf, my money, myself. And that's extended to our tribes. It's so easy to think we're being sacrificial and self-sacrificial when we're taking up for our tribes. But in actuality, what we're doing is standing up for ourselves. The gospel of Jesus, the good news of Jesus, is that God has sent his Son to make one people of all kinds, but one people. We got to quit justifying our ways of getting around that.